This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Yeah, thank you for coming out tonight. It's good to see you all. Glad there's no snowstorm. But even without a snowstorm, it is a commitment to come out on a Friday night to Libri, so I appreciate y'all coming out. This is a part two of a series on gratitude. And the first lecture was just kind of an introduction as to what I'm talking about when I say gratitude, specifically in terms of biblical teaching. What is the Christian kind of view of gratitude? This lecture tonight is dealing with a specific problem, I think, or a specific obstacle to gratitude. The title is The Tug of War Between Entitlement and Thankfulness. I want to just give, because it is a series, and a lot of what I'll say tonight will make more sense with a little bit of a running start. I'm going to give you just a very brief review of the first lecture, just so that the bulk of what I'm saying will make more sense. So these are the main points of the previous lecture on gratitude. So basically, thankfulness in biblical terms is nothing more and nothing less than an acknowledgement of the truth about who God is and who we are. It doesn't try to be anything more than that or less than that. And the Bible teaches us that a lot of the foolishness, perhaps most of the foolishness that humans find themselves in, begins with a failure to give thanks. That's something near the core of where we go wrong again and again. Starting all the way in the garden, where Satan tempts Adam and Eve to start to view God as a withholder more than a giver. And then continuing on, in Paul's words in Romans 1, when people neither glorify God nor give thanks to him, their foolish hearts are darkened. And so there's an aspect of a failure to give thanks at the heart of all of our folly. And it could often be traced back to that. Failing or refusing to thank God. And then in this first lecture, we made a distinction between gratitude and thanksgiving. Now, this may be sort of an arbitrary semantic distinction that I decided to come up with. It may not be everybody's way of using the words. But gratitude I described as an internal awareness of having received goodness and a feeling of benevolence towards the source of that goodness. But the emphasis is on it's an internal experience. It's an emotional state, as opposed to thanksgiving, which is an outward expression of gratitude. So thanksgiving is actually saying thank you to somebody outwardly. But it's clear that the two belong together, right? Either on their own is incomplete. So gratitude without thanksgiving, I called thanksgiving. When we're grateful, we should express it. That's part of what to be a integrated human being should look like. The other half of that is thanksgiving without gratitude is thanks speaking. So our words should correspond to our genuine internal state, right? What we say aloud should reflect what we're feeling inside ourselves. So gratitude, this internal sense of having been blessed, and then thanksgiving, this external expression of that, should go together. And again, like I said, the integrated person feels grateful and then says thank you. This is equally true, I think, when we receive gifts from other people as when we receive gifts from God. The same principle applies. So all thankfulness starts with recognizing a gift as a gift. That's another key point from the first lecture. Recognizing a gift for what it actually is. To be a thankful person means being able to interpret your own story in such a way that you recognize gifts as gifts. So it's a very particular way of interpreting your story. From a biblical standpoint and from the perspective of the spiritual life, thankfulness is a really, really, really good idea. That was one of the main themes of my first lecture. I said that in about 200 different ways. It's really inseparable from other Christian virtues. If you think about, and this is the case for lots of things in the Christian life, you try to remove it from its connection to everything else, and everything falls apart. It's all of a piece. But it's interesting to think of Thanksgiving in that way, too. It's like a piece of, if you ever welded two pieces of metal together, it has to do with heating this metal up and adding another compound so that when you're done, it's actually one piece of metal now. You've melted part of these two pieces of metal, and now they're bonded together as one. If you break it, I mean, you can see where the bond is, but if you break it, you really are breaking one piece of metal. It's a similar sort of thing, or at least it's sort of a lame analogy. But try to separate one thing from the other, you end up breaking both. And this is the relationship, I think, between Thanksgiving and a host of other Christian virtues. Humility, for instance. Try to imagine one without the other. Try to imagine humility without Thanksgiving or Thanksgiving without humility. It takes humility to say thank you to somebody else. It's acknowledging that somebody has provided something for you. Try to imagine joy without Thanksgiving. Try to imagine hope without Thanksgiving. Try to imagine a right relationship with God at all without Thanksgiving. That's basically where I'll end my review of the first lecture. There's more, obviously more to it than that, but tonight we're going to take a little bit of a different perspective. And so, if thankfulness is such an obviously good thing, why is there so much ingratitude everywhere we look? In other people, in our culture at large, as we look around us, and in ourselves, if we're honest. Even those of us who supposedly know better about thankfulness struggle to be thankful. People, including ourselves, can be totally oblivious to all the ways that others are doing things for them all the time. We simply don't notice. Gifts are not recognized as gifts all the time. So thankfulness doesn't actually come naturally to us. It takes attentiveness and humility, and it takes a lot of the time conscious effort. So it is a very particular way of interpreting our stories, and there are other ways to interpret them. And we're presented with other options all the time. The Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky, who wrote Crime and Punishment, Brothers Karamazov, he has a famous one-liner where he sort of summarizes what human beings are. And he says, "I believe the best definition of man is the ungrateful biped." And so if you're gonna sum up what a human being is, this is about the great novelist who is this incredibly gifted at characterization and understanding human nature, right? He's an amazing writer, and he understands people and how they work. Anyway, this is how he basically sums it up. We walk on 2 feet, and we're ungrateful. And so this is obviously, it sounds very, very dark and cynical. He is a Russian writer. But wow, like this, really? That's how you would sum up a human being. It's something, it's a statement both of our fallenness, of the ways in which we are broken, but also of the heights from which we fell. I think because animals are not expected by God to be consciously grateful, but we are, because of who we are. And so humans, uniquely in creation, are expecting to recognize gifts as gifts and to say thank you to God. But, you know, part of the... motivation for this lecture is, how do we defy Dostoevsky's definition just a little bit, even though it may be basically true? How do we defy it or make it slightly less true than it is? How do we grow in our capacity for gratitude? And one of the ways is to start by identifying and trying to dismantle the obstacles in our path. So we have to ask, what is actually keeping us from genuine thankfulness? What are the obstacles? And there are many. Tonight I just want to talk about one that's so broad and so general that it kind of covers a lot of the bases in terms of what keeps us from gratitude, and that's entitlement. And I'll spend a long time talking about what I mean by that and then giving examples of that, and hopefully we won't be too depressed by the end. I'll try to end with some hope. Entitlement, I think, is a culture-wide problem, particularly in the contemporary West. And particularly, you could probably generalize in more affluent communities. It's not just a culture-wide problem, but it's a personal, spiritual problem in each of us as well. So we can look outward and see it in other people quite easily. Other people's entitlement kind of gets all over us, and we're like, whoa, they're entitled. It's much harder to see it in ourselves as we look inwardly. it's a widespread characteristic of the human condition, I would say, meaning that it's a problem we all, unfortunately, share, regardless of religion, of upbringing, economic status, race, ethnicity. Christians and non-Christians alike struggle with entitlement. And so when I say, you'll hear this term, entitled people, I'll say this quite a lot throughout the evening. I'm not referring to some different class of sinner from myself. I'm not, for instance, targeting millennials only, who are supposedly the most entitled generation in history. You know who you are, I guess. It impacts all of us, and it impacts how we view ourselves, it impacts how we relate to other people, and it impacts how we relate to God. Our relationship to God is hugely impacted. And that's really kind of the direction I'm heading in by the end of the lecture. What happens when we have an attitude of entitlement before God? So my outline, it's basic. What is entitlement? What are some of the signs and symptoms? What are some of the things that contribute to it around us? In what sense is it really an enemy of thankfulness? And then, is there anything we can do? Make sure we try to leave time for that last section. So what is entitlement? The word has political origins. And even today, to be entitled can mean that you literally possess a title. So this is a picture of not the real Queen Elizabeth, but the actress who plays Queen Elizabeth in The Crown. Let's just leave that image up there for a minute. So this title gives you special rights and privileges. It means that you have a legitimate, even a legal grounds for laying claim to something. If you hold the title, like the Duke of York or the King of Sweden or the Queen of England, along with that title comes certainly lots of responsibilities, but also certain privileges that are appropriate to that title. Certain things that are simply your due because of that title. So my wife and I have been watching this series, and there's lots of examples of royal duties and royal entitlements. Interestingly, the most entitled character in the whole story is the uncle who has abdicated the throne, who is no longer really royalty, but he expects all of the privileges of royalty still, right? Interestingly, the series is really about some of the ways in which she gives up her just normal human entitlements in order out of her sense of duty. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that. But that's the formal sort of political sense of the word. But there are also things that normal people who are not kings and queens can appropriately lay claim to in life, I think. If I don't have a teenage son, but my son will someday be a teenager, if he took the car and wasn't back until 3 in the morning, I would feel entitled to an answer about where he's been. Given my relationship to him, it's appropriate that I expect that information. you could say that in the context of our relationship, I deserve an explanation. Where have you been all night? There's a book, recently published book by Dr. John Townsend. He's the one of the guys who wrote this book on boundaries. But the Entitlement Cure, Finding Success in Doing Hard Things the Right Way. He promises a lot in his title. anyway, but he does say a lot of helpful things. He distinguishes between two legitimate kinds of deserving. And this is an idea that I think just sort of keep in the back of your minds. We deserve something when we've clearly earned it according to some prior agreement. Say a paycheck from your employer for the work that you've done. You deserve your paycheck if you did your week's worth of work. You're entitled to that. You deserve it. Your employer agreed to pay you ahead of time. There was probably some sort of papers signed agreeing to that. If your employer does not pay you, you have a legitimate grievance. You have a right to object. That's the first kind of legitimate kind of deserving that he talks about. The second is we can say we deserve something if we have a contractual right to it, like when a legal entity confers a right upon you. People who are citizens of the United States have the right to vote, conferred on them by the nation's government, guaranteed, or in theory protected by the nation's government. Once you're a citizen, you don't earn the right to vote. You have the right to vote by virtue of being a citizen. So it's conferred upon you. You are entitled to it. In that sense, you deserve to vote like any other citizen of a country. And these are good and appropriate kinds of entitlements. So we talk about people having rights, and this is a very good thing that governments should try to defend. Obviously, there's lots of controversy over what constitutes a human right and what actually really isn't, but I'm not going to get into that. The very concept of human rights is actually founded originally on the Judeo-Christian idea of the image of God, that every person, no matter who they are, race, ethnicity, whatever, is made in the image of God and has dignity that has to be protected. So that doesn't come from anywhere except Genesis, really, that concept. But I want to talk about a different kind of thing, and that is a general attitude of entitlement towards life as a whole. When we say someone is entitled in this sense, we mean that they live with an inappropriate assumption that certain privileges are their due or their right when they aren't necessarily. So whereas Queen Elizabeth can legitimately claim certain particular privileges, she has a weekly audience with the Prime Minister. I'm not sure if that's a privilege or not, but she gets to meet with the Prime Minister once a week, and I don't. As opposed to that, I'm talking about illegitimate or baseless claims to good things. There's a big difference between being entitled and feeling and acting entitled, right? The two aren't necessarily the same thing. And so this is what I call an unexamined attitude of deservedness. That's sort of my working definition for entitlement. An unexamined attitude of deservedness towards good things. Sometimes an attitude of entitlement is justified by people in their own minds, but it's not the same thing as really examining the attitude to justify it, if you think about it. For instance, I worked hard all day. I deserve to have dinner waiting for me. And I'm going to sit and watch the football game, etc. This is not the same thing as saying, I worked hard all day, I deserve to receive my paycheck. The latter example is an appropriate claim to make because you actually have a previous arrangement with your employer, like I said before. You get paid for working. There's an intrinsic connection between work and payment, right? There's no actual intrinsic connection between working all day and watching a football game. Necessarily. Now, you may have worked that out with your spouse, and that's an arrangement, and that's maybe fine. There may be just nothing wrong with that at all. But there's not a lot, they're not logically bound together. I worked hard, that therefore I get to eat dinner in front of the TV and zone out. Your spouse might have had a harder day than you. Who knows? What are some of the objects of our entitlement? what kinds of things are we likely to feel entitled to? And I'm just going to rapid fire kind of spit out a bunch of thoughts, and more things will sort of come up throughout the lecture, more examples. And I just, for the sake of alliteration, came up with a cheesy three E's here: extravagances, enrichment, and then essentials. And I think from the outset we need to rid ourselves of the notion that entitlement is only a problem for the very rich, the people who demand extravagances, right? Ferraris and perfect service at expensive restaurants, first-class seats, VIP treatment, fame and admiration, tropical vacations, those kinds of things. Entitlement is much more of a widespread and subtle thing than this. Many people in every socioeconomic class and category feel entitled to certain things, certain enrichments in life. Under the category of enrichment, I don't even know if all these things fit under that category, but I'm just going to just relax and listen to this list, okay? Free time and the right to do what I want with it. Access to information that I want. Efficient interactions at the checkout counter. Good health. Interesting, fulfilling work and a work environment in which we are appreciated. Access to entertainment. A level of sexual fulfillment. A level of general comfort in life. Friends who listen and truly care. The ability, which oftentimes means the time and the money, to travel and see the world. A liberal arts education. The time and space for self-exploration. Now, all these things are good things. We don't exactly need them to survive, but they do contribute a lot to someone's quality of life, maybe. Not everybody has access to the things I just listed, but they are things that many of us feel entitled to. And then there's actually the really essentials, the things without which we would die. And most of us, whether we realize it or not, actually do feel entitled to these basic necessities, right? We feel entitled to food, water, clean air, shelter, access to some kind of health care, and some kind of connection with other human beings, some sort of social connection, which is necessary for any human being to thrive. Now, again, these are very good and necessary things, but the question of whether we're actually entitled to them is a complicated one. Because there's always the difference between entitlement in terms of what the government provides, in terms of rights. That's one issue. And then there's a much deeper, more ultimate sense. Am I entitled before God for these things? So it may be very good for us to have each one of these things, but it's not necessarily good for us to feel entitled to them. I'm going to move on to what are some of the signs and symptoms . What does it look like? How would we recognize it? And of course, it can look very different in different people. But again, just a reminder that we all struggle with this to some degree or other, depending on our upbringing, depending on the assumptions that have been built into us as children, whatever. There's all kinds of reasons, all kinds of ways in which each of us maybe struggle with these things to different degrees. All right, so I'm stating things in pretty extreme form right here, not because I think every single one of us, this describes every single one of us. But anyway, first, very often, entitlement is an attitude that we are exceptional in some way. And because we're exceptional, regular hardships or inconveniences shouldn't happen to us. I should have special access to privileges, and I should have special exemption from difficulty, labor, or accountability. There's a great fodder for a lot of this is just reading the New Yorker cartoons. There's just endless, I don't even have one to show you as an illustration, but there's one where these two, husband and a wife, sitting there, and the wife is asking for a divorce, and she says to her husband, You're not part of the story I want to tell about my life. Brutal, right? There's a Randy Newman song called My Life is Good, which is just a similar kind of thing. It's like the teacher calls him up because his son at school is being a bully, and he's like, wait, no, shut up. My life is good. That's his response, right? Like, no, don't tell me that. You know, that doesn't happen to me. Basically, the story of my life has to be awesome, and you just don't fit into that story, right? Secondly, unsurprisingly, an attitude of entitlement is often at the root of a poor work ethic. So, good benefits that people receive from working hard are viewed by the entitled person as something that should be delivered to them. The benefits of hard work delivered to them. We may have developed quite a detailed imaginative vision for the type of future we want to have, what we consider the good life, the type of life we desire. That might be quite a developed vision, but we may have thoroughly unrealistic vision of everything we would have to do to get there, right? So entitlement leads us to expect to find shortcuts to that vision. Many people are passionate about their work or passionate about the idea of some sort of field of work, but expect a level of mastery without the long apprenticeship, right? I want to achieve a level of mastery without the long apprenticeship. The hard work of actually learning that craft or whatever it is. So entitlement tends to include a lack of the patience and perseverance it really takes to become skilled. It really takes to master something. Sarah Chestnut, one of our workers here, did a lecture earlier this term on creativity, and she had this wonderful term. I'm not sure where it came from or whether she coined it herself, but ease as an indicator of right. So if something is easy, that must be the way I'm supposed to go. You know, if something is challenging and difficult, oh, that must be the wrong decision. I shouldn't do that because it's hard, right? And that's quite dangerous when we start thinking that way in terms of God's guidance, right? That's too hard. God doesn't want me to do that. You know, oh, this is easy. That must be my call. You know, something I'm called to. So ease as an indicator of right. That's a really articulate kind of way of putting something that's actually quite sinister, I think, in our culture. Thirdly, entitlement often manifests itself as a resistance to responsibility, both the responsibility of having to work hard to achieve anything, but also the responsibility of owning up to our mistakes. So this whole idea of accountability. Entitlement makes us very, very uncomfortable with accountability. When people expect me to do something to repair the damage that I've caused, I resent it. And this can be a sign of entitlement. I shouldn't have to pick up after I shouldn't have to do that. That's for somebody else to deal with. And so we do see a trend in this sort of evasion of responsibility in our universities. And this is as an article back in 2007, which is actually kind of a long time ago now, called Academic Success Entitlement by a guy named John Lombardi. He's a professor. He's been a professor at a number of different universities and a university president. So he has experience both in the classroom and as an administrator. And I'll read a quote, and then I'll put the second half of the quote up on the screen. At one time, we imagined that students came to the university to learn, that they had an obligation to engage their courses and faculty, read, write, study, take exams, and demonstrate their achievement. This simple approach placed the responsibility for learning on the students, who we assumed recognized that the privilege of attending a college carried with it a commitment to the learning process. We expected the faculty to know their subject, prepare for class, provide support and advice, hold office hours, give fair and effective examinations, mark papers with care, and provide a grade that reflected what the students had learned. This simple formulation has suffered considerable modification over the years. Today we believe students are entitled to attend college, that they have a right to achieve a standard level of academic accomplishment, and that the institutions have an obligation to ensure their learning meets this standard by the time they leave. In this formulation, the students' responsibilities lie in attendance, but their academic success becomes the responsibility of the institution. When graduation rates are low or students fail to meet some testable standard, we assume that the institution failed, not that the student failed. Indeed, if the student fails, the remedy is to punish the institution and its teachers. The academic success entitlement that students enjoy reflects a broader belief that institutions need to guarantee results, not opportunity. So, pretty critical view of the modern university. Thankfully, not necessarily equally true everywhere, but certainly I think a trend that's can be verified in a lot of places. So academic success is coming to be viewed as the appropriate reward for showing up and paying tuition, right? It's a transaction. If I show up and pay tuition, I should get a good grade, right? The notion that universities offer the opportunity to work hard in order to learn something is becoming a less common attitude. And I think there's lots of anecdotes. And again, this depends a lot on a person's upbringing. A lot of people grow up in communities in which nobody expects to go to college. So I'm not trying to say this is universal, but this is just a common attitude among people who are in universities. Okay, fourth. Sometimes an inability to distinguish between the things we want and the things we need is a sign of entitlement. So entitlement causes us to view everything as having need status. The prospect of being denied something we really want can be a real crisis, even though it's not essential. Fifth, this is one that I think is I think probably has been a part of some of our stories. For the entitled person, other people's sacrifices made for them become normalized. So they're often surrounded by one or more scurrying friends or scurrying family members, people whose job it is to make sure that the universe delivers according to expectations, right? So I think for this reason, entitlement can make people really difficult. The term high maintenance was coined in reference to entitled people. When we're acting entitled, we're a trial to the people around us because we're carrying expectations with us that the reality can't actually really supply unless people are scurrying around to make sure it happens for us. Another sign and symptom, number six, chronic frustration and self-pity. These are often symptoms of entitlement. Often, this is because our expectations do not really match up to reality, and we get disappointed. And our unrealistic expectations are set up for this. And unless our entitlement is actually challenged, this is the final destination of all entitlement. Disillusionment, bitterness, maybe loneliness. Our very frustration towards the routine inconveniences of life can be the best indication of the things we feel entitled to. What do I get really mad about when it's denied me? My own deep frustration towards interruptions has revealed to me over the years that I actually feel quite entitled to my time. It's mine. My time is my own. Having small children helps to deflate that a bit. But anyone who in work or at home or whatever, when you have interruptions and you get angry, sometimes you really have to get something done and you get frustrated and it's who can blame you. But the same, sometimes that frustration is a sign you really feel entitled to your time. You really think it's yours, right? There's a chapter in the Screwtape Letters. I won't read it now, but there's a wonderful chapter about how the more things we feel entitled to, the more grievances we'll experience when they're taken away. And we don't get angry about just disappointments. We get angry about disappointments that we perceive as grievances, injuries to me, right? And time is a big one. How dare someone interrupt me? That time was mine, and now it's gone. Seven. This is one last symptom, I think, of entitlement, and that is that we devalue good things. So when we take good things for granted and view them as our due, we usually devalue them. I have been blessed in my life. I've never really had to wonder if I would have enough food to eat. I've been hungry before, but never always by choice, basically. I've never had to wonder whether would I have food tomorrow to eat. And so it's one of those things when we pray, give us this day our daily bread. It's hard for me to sort of experience the urgency of that prayer, the way it wouldn't be for somebody else who hasn't had as privileged an upbringing. So, because of this, I'm in danger of viewing food as such a basic blessing that it goes without saying that I'll have it, right? Such a basic thing. So necessary. So, when my wife and I are low on money in a given month, we decide not to buy anything except the food we need and basic necessities, the food we need for that month. No trips to Starbucks, no Amazon purchases, no fishing gear or anything like that. It's quite easy to get into the mindset that I'm enduring a real hardship because food is all I can afford, right? Just food. Just the basic necessities that should go without saying, right? And you see what I've done. And this is not a conscious thing. This is not something I even would say outwardly, but it's an internal kind of subtle thing. Because I view a blessing as an entitlement, I'm incapable of valuing it as highly as I actually should. This is food, right? Familiarity can breed contempt when it comes to blessings, right? Food is the most essential and probably one of the most enjoyable gifts of God. The most tangible sign that we're being cared for by God. That we have something to eat. Without it, we all die. To have food is a really big deal. Many people don't. And yet I can't see its true value because I feel entitled to it. So entitlement leads to devaluing of really good and important things. That's the point. There's a wonderful thing I used to hear people say in that the church my parents still attend is an African-American church, and I grew up there through my high school years. And something that I heard lots of people say, sort of as almost a beginning to prayer, is, thank you, Lord, you woke us up this morning. Mm-hmm. And this is, I heard it so many times, my first couple times hearing that, I'm like, wow, that's kind of, I mean, isn't God going to do big things for me today? Like, isn't that sort of like a kind of a low bar for God, just getting me up, getting me out of bed in the morning? But it's very similar to this attitude towards food. Mm-hmm. You know, wait till you can't get out of bed in the morning, then you won't feel the same way about this, right? Getting out of bed in the morning is actually hugely important. It just happens every morning to me, so I don't think of it as being particularly important or valuable. So we've been talking about signs and symptoms of entitlement, but it's often not this simple. One of the difficulties about entitlement is that most of the time it's not directly articulated. We never actually admit that we're being entitled. There's a blindness and a self-deception at the heart of it that makes us unaware that that's what we're actually doing. So we assume good things are due us. And it doesn't occur to us that it could be otherwise. It goes without saying. These are all ways of saying that it's something that functions on the level of assumptions most of the time, which means it's very difficult to examine in ourselves. How do you know what you're assuming, right? What you assume is what you don't think about, right? More often than not, we act entitled for no reason other than we're used to getting the particular thing. We've been accustomed to it. There's nothing more to it than that, very often. Blessings have become familiar to us. And this is one of the things that actually being disciplined in thanksgiving is really, really important. Without being disciplined in thanksgiving, we inevitably move towards viewing all of God's blessings as just something that's inevitable to come to us. But there's a lot of things that contribute to our entitlement in life. So why are we so entitled? This is contributors. Where does it come from? And again, there's many, many different answers. We can't blame any one thing. I'm just going to give some examples. And I'm sure that most of you could come up with more things. So we're full of, our culture is full of factors that contribute to it. I'm not going to back up and give sort of a history of American individualism or the effect that the American dream has had on our sense of being entitled. The American dream means different things to different people. But one thing I will say is that one of our nation's founding principles is in the Declaration of Independence. It was a phrase coined by Thomas Jefferson. It's like the government should protect certain unalienable rights, among them being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But I wonder whether this phrase, the pursuit of happiness, which implies real effort and striving, has been subconsciously replaced in the American mind simply with the word happiness. Mm. Right? So that being American implies the right to happiness rather than the opportunity to pursue it through hard work. Right? Life, liberty, and happiness. And again, most of us wouldn't say this, but it's, the question is, what are we assuming? So as we look around us right now, what are some of the contributors? Certainly, advertising is a huge contributor to entitlement. The analogy in my mind is, if our entitlement is a fire that's burning, ads are just like a constant fan on the flame, just making sure it's nice and healthy and burning bright. Consumer entitlement is very, very good for business. Consumers are supposed to be entitled. Otherwise, the economy would suffer, right? Think of all the times you've been told that you deserve something by people who don't know you at all. I was walking along the street, and I found this D'Angelo's cup. You deserve a little something special. Satisfaction, a fair chance, ice cold refreshment. It's an iced tea from D'Angelo's, right? Remarkable. How do the good people of D'Angelo's know that I deserve their iced tea? I might be lazy and rude and selfish, and they don't know. So advertisers, I think, know that we like to feel that we deserve things. We like to feel deserving. It feels good to feel deserving. I like to think of myself as hardworking, righteous, and worthy. When we feel hardworking, righteous, and worthy, we find it easy to justify buying things we do not need. Right? If I feel that I'm a really hardworking person, it's way easier to justify buying things I don't need. I do so much. I give so much. This is an important moment of self-care for me. This purchase. Now, I mean, the advertising is so intentional, right? They're not stupid, and it works. So think of all the ads that try and sell you something by telling you, you work hard, do something for you, you deserve it, treat yourself, spoil yourself. They're sort of planting seeds of entitlement, or probably it's more accurate to say they're exploiting and nourishing entitlement that's already there in us. Not that it is always wrong to treat yourself from time to time or to do something you really enjoy when you're burnt out and tired and you've been working hard. I'm not trying to be all moralistic about that, that, you know, somehow if you enjoy yourself or spend time doing something you enjoy, you must be entitled. I'm not trying to claim that at all. But what I am saying is that we need to ask ourselves, what are these constant messages of deservedness doing to us? They're doing something to us. I mean, we buy stuff because of it. So is that all we're doing? Is that all that's happening? Are they subtly inflating my pride? Are they providing me with a distorted self-image? Are they subtly impacting how I treat other people? Do I expect to be given special treatment? Do I feel that the world owes me something because I am me? Might this have something to do with the fact that everywhere I turn, I'm being told I'm special? I think the deeper question is, might this be impacting how I view myself before God? Attitudes of entitlement tend to spill over into other aspects of our lives. They don't stay in their compartments. So if I just feel entitled to all kinds of nice conveniences in life, and I expect other people to do things for me, it's very unlikely that that attitude won't spill over into my theology, right? Where every part of us is connected to every other part of us. Technology is obviously a big contributor to our entitlement. Technology has probably always had the potential to fuel human entitlement, probably from the very beginning. I don't know. It saves us labor or streamlines some aspect of our life, sometimes in very good and important ways. Then we become accustomed to the new level of convenience that it provides. And then our standard for what is acceptable and unacceptable changes, right? The technology that brought technology brings about a new normal. So that expression, the new normal, very often is made possible by technology or some new development in technology. There's a new normal today, but the new normal is always changing. So tomorrow there's going to be a newer normal enabled by technology. Our entitlement, I think, is revealed to us when the technology fails or we lose access to it. We get angry because yesterday's normal is too slow, or too cumbersome, too boring, too much work. And this is true not just about, you know, high-end digital technology. It's, you know, last week there was a storm in which numerous communities in Massachusetts lost power for several days. Half of Southborough was without power. Now, this is a return to the normal of 150 years ago. And you suddenly notice the stuff you just feel entitled to, the stuff that you never think about because electricity is there all the time. So think of the way that the credit card has changed us, the technology of the credit card. Does anyone remember going to a store as a kid and seeing something you really, really wanted, but going home because it's expensive? You go home and you do chores for your parents, you save up money until the cash in your bank account matches or exceeds the price tag of the thing you want. And until that day arrives, you couldn't have it, right? Does anyone remember that? I mean, now that sounds like a Norman Rockwell painting. That scenario of like, this thing I want, I'm going to save up and I'm going to do my chores until I have enough money to go buy it, right? That's the great thing to encourage in our children, a great attitude that we should be actually trying. Don't buy stuff you can't afford. But when people want something badly enough today, you usually don't even have to leave the house. You buy it online, whether or not you have the money for it, and it arrives either the next day or maybe a little later. The idea of waiting until you can afford something sounds kind of quaint, I think. And that's the reason why we have so much credit card debt. I mean, people are in hundreds of thousands of dollars of credit card debt because we have this attitude that we're entitled to have what we want now. And I wasn't able to actually find the reference for this, but I remember Oz Guinness a number of years ago, I think it was Bank of America, that actually like developed the technology of the credit card and sort of tried to sell it at first, early on. And one of the slogans to sell the credit card as a concept to people was taking the waiting out of wanting. Right? Brilliant! That was an amazing slogan. Taking the waiting out of wanting, right? By brilliant, I mean, you know, sinister. But really, really, I mean, that's what it is. That's what it is. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about digital technology, but I'll say a couple things. Probably everybody in the room knows more about it than I do. So I think many of us act like we have a right to what Andy Crouch calls easy everywhere. He wrote a book called The Tech-Wise Family. It's not a great title because it doesn't just apply to families. It's quite a helpful, very concise book about how to interact with technology in your home, whether or not you have kids or whatever. But easy everywhere is what he says we've come to expect. Immediate, streamlined access to information, goods and services and entertainment. Most of the time through our device we have in our hand. And this has drastically altered how we relate to time, most of and access to information. Most of us feel entitled not to have to wait for much of anything. We often expect immediate responses from people that we text or email or message on Facebook. Anything less than instant feels slow. So, there's a lot of other just examples of entitlement, not necessarily contributors to it, but examples that we can see culturally. I think, is anyone familiar with the term snowflake in universities? Now this is controversial. I don't necessarily want to get into a big debate about this, but increasingly on university campuses, students, and there's trends that are showing this, and a lot of professors that are distressed about this. Students are acting like they have the right to not be exposed to ideas or opinions that they find upsetting, right? Trigger warnings are something that professors often have to give before they read something that might upset somebody, so that you know ahead of time that you might find this traumatic. And I think the motivation is very good. Very often it's about racially charged things that people really need to be thinking about. But there's just a growing assumption of a high level of sensitivity among university students for all different kinds of reasons. Comments or opinions or that 20 years ago might have gotten on our nerves and might have stimulated some debate are now called microaggressions. And there are safe spaces designated on university campuses where people can go when they're feeling traumatized about the words that other people have said. So there's this right to feel safe in the sphere of academics and ideas. Not feeling safe on campus as in safe from getting assaulted. I mean safe from ideas. Safe from other people's thoughts. Many Americans are worried that college students feel increasingly entitled to learn without ever being disturbed. And often what this means is not having to come into contact with views that strongly differ from my own. And so this is where this term snowflake comes from. It's not a complimentary term, and it may be unkind, but anyway, it's a term that people are using. It refers to a sensitivity that can't tolerate the tension of hearing opinions that might be offensive. So that's just one example. Another example of entitlement, which I find infinitely more disturbing, is a trend in our broader culture, but particularly in politics of late. The right to have my beliefs respected as equally valid to everybody else's, no matter what they are. The right to call any information I don't like fake news. The right to present any other information that I like more as an alternative fact. And people have been doing that for a long time, and expecting to be taken seriously. This is an attitude that has long been held about what we used to call opinions, views, values, you know, but now seems to apply to verifiable facts, things that you could go and count, but everybody has their right to their own facts. Now, so there's a very disturbing article in The Atlantic a couple issues back by Kurt Anderson called How America Lost Its Mind. And it's basically talking about this transition of a relativism towards values and supposedly subjective things, a relativism that has expanded into the realm of facts and science and verifiable information. Anyway. The entitlement to have anything I feel is true to be respected as true. Another just broad contributor is the attitude that we should be able to have it all. We shouldn't have to give up anything in order to have something else we want. This idea of sacrificing something in order to have something else has fallen on very hard times. Daniel Boorstin, years ago, wrote this book, The Image, and there's this perfect quote from this. He's arguing that we, in the modern West, have an extravagant and contradictory expectations of life. And he's getting at an important aspect of entitlement here. So he says, we expect anything and everything. We expect the contradictory and the impossible. We expect compact cars that are spacious, luxurious cars which are economical. We expect to be rich and charitable, powerful and merciful, active and reflective, kind and competitive. We expect to eat and stay thin, to be constantly on the move and ever more neighborly, to go to the church of our choice and yet feel its guiding power over us, to revere God and to be God. Never have people been more the masters of their environment, yet never has a people felt more deceived and disappointed, for never has a people expected so much more than the world could offer. And we could add to his list of unrealistic, contradictory expectations. Things that just blatantly don't make sense together, right? A couple of things. Like, I expect to go to bed late and then pop out of bed in the morning feeling awesome. I expect better government services and lower taxes. We're promised that all the time. We expect to be exhibitionists on social media and have our privacy respected, right? This is just... How do you figure? Like, how would those two... So Boorstin is very, very insightful. I think he's right. We often have expectations of life and dreams and aspirations that completely contradict each other. But because these assumptions go unexamined, we don't really notice the contradiction. We don't notice the absurdity, right? We just head down this road of discontent, basically, not quite knowing why. I'm not going to talk about it right now for the sake of time, but there's an interesting motivational speaker and marketing consultant called Simon Sinek. Has anybody listened to this guy? He has this video, his interview, which is, people call it like the most inspiring motivational speech, but it's not a motivational speech at all. Anyway, he has a lot to say about entitlement and millennials and basically the failed parenting strategy of a whole generation of parents preparing kids to expect to be treated like they're special and to be rewarded for coming in last and all these things, and they get to the workplace and it's just a total crisis. Anyway, go check that out. Simon Sinek. S-I-N-E-K, not C-Y-N-I-C. It's Sinek. I don't know. Anyway, the enemy of thankfulness. In what sense is this the enemy of thankfulness? And my title was a tug of war, the image of a tug of war. And there is a tug of war going on between thankfulness and entitlement, both in the culture and in ourselves. The reason I use this image is that when there's a tug of war, when one side is winning, the other is losing in exactly the same amount that the other side is winning, if that makes sense, to the same degree. You cannot have both entitlement and thanksgiving thriving in your heart. It's kind of a zero-sum game. If one is thriving, the other is wasting away. Inversely proportional. However you want to think about it. Why? Because it's impossible to be truly thankful for something and feel entitled to it at the same time. Thankfulness, like we said earlier, starts by recognizing a gift as a gift, as something freely given by another under no obligation. That's what a gift means. It's not a paycheck, it's a gift. There was no obligation, but it was given anyway. Something that was not inevitable or to be taken for granted. Neither is a gift something that we are owed by the giver. So, insofar as I view something as my right or my due, I cannot view it as a gratuitous gift. I'll feel no inclination to turn to anyone else in thanks for something that I feel entitled to. So I think this is true of our interactions with human givers. If my kids feel entitled to their Christmas presents, it will be hard for them to offer genuine thanks to all the people that gave them gifts. So this is. I think overly cynical, but imagine this little internal monologue going on in your head. It's Christmas. It's the time of year when I get presents. Don't the grown-ups sort of have to give me presents? It's sort of their job. What's the big deal saying thank you so much to everyone? I was hoping for something else anyway. Whatever. If this is their attitude, to say thank you will seem like a meaningless duty, right? because they feel entitled to those things. I'm not saying that they actually do, but we're working on that. However inappropriate and self-centered that sounds, our attitude of entitlement before God is even more out of place and inappropriate than that, right? It's even more destructive. If I strive to follow Christ, if I'm a faithful member of a church, if I try to live the life that God is calling me to, maybe if I've even made sacrifices out of obedience to Christ, I may very well feel that I have sort of done my part, and now it's God's turn to do His. I think some of us have grown up with a verse from Psalm 37 taken out of context. Take delight in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. It's interesting to read that whole psalm. It's all in the context of our despair at wicked people succeeding in what they do. It's a very particular context of, but that's a popular verse to take out of context. If I just delight in the Lord and I try hard and I love God, He's going to give me the desires of my heart. But we assume that means anything that I really want, right? Have you ever felt that God sort of owes you a certain way of life? Now, this is, again, a lot of times this is the level of assumption, not what we would actually say out loud. Do you view certain blessings as standard issue, kind of baseline blessings that God is basically obligated to provide, but He can add to it anytime He likes? That's sort of like the cup overflowing. But there's a basic level of comfort, ease, success that I should enjoy for being a Christian. If I view this kind of security, comfort, fulfillment, whatever, as simply being what I should get for being a Christian, I'm never going to be appropriately thankful to God. I'll actually be increasingly bitter and unable to recognize gifts as gifts. And remember, thankfulness is a particular way of interpreting our stories such that gifts are recognized as gifts. So, when articulated bluntly like this, God owes me a good life, very few of us would actually say this. But in many circles, I'll just give a couple of examples of the way this actually is an assumption. In many circles, in Christian communities, there's kind of a cultural expectation that every young Christian will one day be married. People refer to when I get married. Who knows if you're going to get married? You might not. I mean, marriage is a blessing. But nobody knows if they're going to get married. But I think there's an assumption in lots of Christian communities that since marriage is good, then you will surely be married. That kind of assumption has probably led people into a lot of quite unsuitable marriages. What about having children? When I have kids of my own. Nobody knows if they're going to have kids before they have kids. A lot of people struggle with infertility who are married. And, I mean, I knew someone once who wasn't married but was already buying baby clothes. So there's something there. Like, whoa, you feel entitled to something here that you have no idea whether God is actually going to give you. It's a gift. Many Christians feel that if they throw their energy into some ministry, God should and will always bless it with success. Many of us feel that we should always be given a clear and hence fulfilling sense of how we're being used by God. I expect to see the impact I'm making for the kingdom, you know, as I follow Him. Really? Not always. It's a blessing when it happens, but is it something that we're entitled to, that we expect, that God owes us? So there are ways in which entitlement within the church actually looks a lot like entitlement outside the church. Back to that phrase, ease indicates rightness. That attitude finds its way into a lot of Christian thinking. Remember the expectation that that we should have mastery without the long apprenticeship. The sort of spiritualized version of that is maturity without discipleship. We see a lot of expectations of maturity without discipleship. We think something must be wrong. The Christian life should be easier. It should be easier to believe in God. I want to believe in God. Why isn't it easier? It should be easier to conquer this particular sin that I cannot get rid of. Victory should be easier over this thing that's a besetting problem in my life. I think a lot of people feel this way about pornography. You know, the Christian life, conquering sin should be easier than this somehow, if this is the truth. I should be able to feel God's presence more readily in my life. I should be given more regular demonstrations of God's reality to bolster my faith. My non-Christian friends shouldn't need so much convincing. Well, why won't they just respond to the gospel? And this is a little bit trickier because I think this is... I'm not trying to trivialize this at all, but say you've really suffered for a long, long, long time. In any number of different ways. It's high time God do something good in my life, right? The ball's in His court. I've done everything I can. None of us know how long that road is going to be, right? I knew someone who struggled with alcohol and drug addiction for a long, long time. And we were talking about it at a table of people, and the phrase "hitting rock bottom" came up, and he just laughed. He's like, "There's always a new bottom. There's always a lower bottom." Right. In a sense, each of these scenarios, we've come to expect something from God, and it seems that He should somehow be bound to deliver it to us. If He does not, well, then He's somehow dropped the ball. A good question to ask is, who has promised us these things, actually? Was a promise ever made? According to what prior arrangement am I expecting these kinds of things? As good as they are. So, really, the gospel challenges entitlement very, very directly. The Bible teaches us that there actually is no room for entitlement before God. This is sort of a painful truth, but we actually don't have rights as we stand before the Lord. We have no grounds for demanding anything from Him. He will never owe anything to us. Sorry, we can never earn anything from Him. We'll never be able to maneuver ourselves into a position of deserving anything from Him. Say if we work really hard. And this is really sort of the uncomfortable truth about the gospel that we have to believe before it becomes good news. This is the bad news before it's the good news. You really can't do it. You can't do anything. You know, He doesn't owe you anything. In the Bible, the people that have the most direct experiences of God, the kind of spiritual experiences we sort of naively think we want very often, are very nearly undone. Both by a sense of their creaturely frailty and dependence on God, but also by a terrifying awareness that their sin needs to be covered. I'm not going to read the passage now, but Isaiah 6 is a wonderful picture of that. Isaiah has this vision of the Lord in the temple, and he's immediately aware of his sin. That's the first thing out of his mouth. Peter has a similar encounter with Jesus in Luke 5, right before Jesus calls him as his disciples. Jesus performs this miracle, and Peter immediately confesses his sin. You know, this is the reaction that people have when they actually have an experience of God in the Bible, right? So both of these states, our dependence and our sinfulness, are only resolved by gift. Our entire existence is gift. The only way anyone stands before God is as a receiver of gifts. That's our status. That's what we are when we're standing in God's presence, by definition. Every breath and heartbeat is an event that's been willed by God, has been gratuitously given in every moment. There's nothing automatic about each breath. We can give nothing to God that isn't already on loan from Him. Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 4 are a special challenge, I think. They're in a specific context, but they're words that I think apply very broadly. And he says this, "For who makes you different from anyone else? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as though you did not? If you received something, why are you boasting as if you didn't receive it, as if it sort of came from yourself? He's talking, the context is he's addressing squabbles. People are arguing over their status based on whose disciple they are. Is it Apollos or is it Paul? And he's saying, you know, anything you have in terms of a spiritual life was a gift to you. Why are you prideful towards each other as if it originated with you? You don't have anything that you didn't receive. And that's the case in a much broader sense than he means there. The fact that we are saved from destruction for our sin, this judgment that we deserve, through the work of Christ is likewise a gratuitous gift, freely given. Whoops. I don't think I put this up on the screen, sorry. Romans 3, Paul writes, "But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There's no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus." So, everybody's in the same category. We've all fallen short. We've fallen out of the sphere of deservedness, and there's no bargaining or earning or presenting of resumes. All we offer, essentially, is our lack. It's what Schaeffer called the empty hands of faith. It's through faith that we receive that salvation, but faith is empty hands. That's what it is. And then God justifies freely. It's free. The only way of life is to receive God's gifts. And actually, his salvation is too valuable to be received in any other way. Some things are too valuable to receive in any way except as a gift. If we try to pay for it in some way, we're actually just insulting the value of that gift and ultimately rejecting it. Right? You only get it as a gift or not at all. So, if this is our true position before God, you can see how absurd it would be to claim rights before him, right? In an entitled way. John Townsend, the guy that wrote this Entitlement Cure book, he has, I'm not sure exactly whether I would do this yet, I'm thinking about it. He did talk to Nikayla about it. He had this sort of mantra he would repeat to his kids over and over again as they were growing up, and it is, "You have many needs, but you deserve nothing." You have many needs, but you deserve nothing. And so he and his wife would then assure their kids that their needs would be met. And that was part of the responsibility of parents. We will do everything we can to meet your needs, but not because you deserve it. Because we love you, it's because we're responsible to you, but you don't deserve it. I don't know. Anyone, parents in the room who could feel comfortable saying that to their kids? Yeah? Good. Yeah, okay. Show of hands. That's true. I mean, it's true. My mom just went, It's not the only thing you'd want to say to your kids. All right.
Provide for your kids.
What's that?
If you don't provide for them, you're worse than an unbeliever.
Yeah. Right. It really is something you're called to. Right. But is it? Yeah.
A little bit.
There'll be a discussion time at the end.
Sorry.
What to do? There's a phrase that. That I hear a lot at Labrie, and I'm not sure where it came from exactly, but reality pushing back. When we live out of sync with reality, eventually, may seem to go well for a while, but eventually reality kind of kicks back. And so the first thing we can do is pay attention to reality pushing back. So in a fallen world in which bad things happen, entitlement leaves us very vulnerable. That's one of the characteristics of entitlement. We're very vulnerable. The more things I feel entitled to, the more potential grievances I have. Entitlement only goes well for us as long as people placate us and make us feel special. And as long as life circumstances line up the way I want them to line up. But because entitlement is not actually grounded in reality, reality has a way of poking holes in it. So most of us at some point in life will not get the things we feel entitled to, and we will experience it as a violation of our rights. There's a quote from Gilbert Mylander. He says, "People are profoundly unhappy because they have lost a sense of gratitude. They can speak only of rights. Health is a right, and sickness is a frustration of this right. Healing, so quick now thanks to antibiotics, is no longer a gift from God. Happiness is a right. Since no one achieves it, despite all our modern conveniences, everyone is a victim of frustration. No gift can bring joy to the one who has a right to everything." That sentence is, "No gift can bring joy to the one who has a right to everything." So we have a choice then, when reality pushes back. Do I keep on claiming entitlement and descend into deeper and deeper disillusionment? Many people do. That's a choice. We can do that. Or do I begin to ask myself certain questions? When reality pushes back, might God be using my disappointment to reveal my entitlement to me that formerly I was blind to? Another question: what is the real basis of my feeling grieved? If I felt like I deserved something, from whom did I deserve it? Usually when we feel we deserve something, we're expecting someone else to deliver something to us, right? Who? Have I been given a promise or not? So this is when I think we really need other people, other Christians in our lives. This is why we need to be connected to churches, friends, family who know us and love us, who can help us try to trace our sense of grievance backwards to an expectation. I think the grievance is what we have. That's in the moment, the emotional response we have, and we're angry at that, you know. But we need to trace that backwards to the expectation that was somehow denied, and maybe never articulated. Very often we're angry because our expectations have been disappointed, but we never really articulated what those were. We didn't even know we had them exactly. And so we need help from people that we love and trust to help us articulate what our expectations were. And then we need to ask, were they realistic? Now, a lot of times we express frustration and anger because totally legitimate expectations have been denied and our grievance is legitimate. So I'm not trying to say that every time you're grieved by something, you're just being entitled. But it's just a good aspect of self-awareness. It's just when we're angry or frustrated about something, trace it back to an expectation. Is this an unrealistic expectation, or is it something that was really legitimate? Secondly, confronting the vice with the virtue. I think we can start giving thanks to people and giving thanks to God whether we feel it or not. Now, outward thanksgiving is meant to correspond to inward gratitude, like we talked about in the beginning. That's what a totally coherent human being looks like. I feel grateful inwardly. I express thanksgiving outwardly. But this is also the real world. Sometimes all we can do, if we know it's appropriate to do it, all we can do is say thanks before we feel it, maybe. This will take intention and discipline. It will take memory. We'll have to remember the things God has done for us in the past. We'll have to remember the things we prayed for that He actually answered, but then we forget about because we have what we want now. Remember what we prayed for. It also takes imagination. What would it be like to not have all the things I have? It'll take engaging with people who are different than yourself. It'll take engaging with people who are more thankful than you. And it may feel inauthentic to us at first because we don't like to say anything that isn't coming from our hearts, right? But if we know that it's the right thing to do, this attempt is actually to get us in touch with reality again, right? That's what saying thank you actually can do over time. As we do over time, we're building up, I think, a defense against entitlement. We'll become more resilient from the kinds of disappointments that come with entitlement. But in the meantime, I think we often are still very like the little kids. If you were a little kid and you were told by your parents, say thank you, you know, what do you say to so-and-so that just gave you something? And you say, oh, thank you, and we sort of go through that motion of saying thank you. And our parents probably told us to say thank you in hopes that someday we will grow into grateful people. It'll actually be who we are rather than just something we say. People who are able to recognize gifts for themselves without being told by someone else that we've just been given something. Right? Very often we're very much like those kids still. We're not as different as we'd like to think sometimes. And then thirdly, always look to Christ himself. I think looking to Christ both as our Savior from the bondage of entitlement, the misery of entitlement. He's the one that sets us free. But also as a model for what freedom from entitlement looks like, his life. And if you think about the irony of the incarnation itself, one way of articulating what the incarnation is, that God himself took on flesh and became a human being, is that the one human being who truly had a legitimate right to make claims before God and people did not. Right? Jesus willingly surrendered his divine rights and privileges, not his divine identity, but his rights and privileges, and gave up his legitimate entitlement all out of love for us. And this is what Paul sort of breaks into song in Philippians 2 to articulate this. Let there be the same mind in you that is in Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. And the language is that of pouring out. He poured himself out. Think of everything that he poured out, given who he was. And so Christ is a model for what it is to be free from entitlement. Even though he's maybe the only human who really was entitled to anything at all. Right? I'm going to conclude here. I'm aware that this lecture has been quite negative. I want to ask the question, can we expect anything from God at all without being entitled? And I don't want to imply that we, you know, if we expect anything from God, therefore we're being, we have a massive entitlement problem. I want to start by turning to, for some nuance, I want to turn to the first chapter of John. And I'll just read this. This is starting in verse 9. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own. Think of the entitlement that implies. This is his own place he's coming to. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We've seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Now this little word, the right to become children of God, some translations say the authority to become children of God. And it almost sounds like we have a right to demand something, right? If we have the authority and the right, what is this right that John is telling us that we have? It's not a right that's based on our performance in any way. Interestingly, it's the right to be born, which is a wonderfully fitting metaphor here, because none of us earned our first physical birth. We weren't able to do much to earn that. Similarly, none of us can earn our second spiritual birth, right? It's birth. Someone else has to do the work, right? We cannot appeal to any reason in ourselves why God should adopt us, but we can appeal to His love, His character, His promises with this strange authority that John is talking about. Our right is not out of place because it comes from our total confidence in the person of Jesus Christ and what He's done to guarantee our new birth. So through Him, we've been adopted, this image of adoption, which is a very rich theological thing in the Bible, that we've been adopted back into this family. We're no longer orphans. So through Him, we've been adopted into God's family forever, and we can stand on the legal authority of that adoption. It's sort of this legal transaction, because God's character is what guarantees it. And so this right has been conferred on us by Jesus Christ. So I think if we go back to John Townsend's distinction between the two legitimate kinds of deserving. Remember in the very beginning we talked about there's two ways in which we can say we legitimately deserve something, although that word still gives me the heebie-jeebies. But anyway, the first kind of deserving is a person deserves something when they've clearly earned it, remember, like your paycheck. The second is if a right has been conferred on you by some sort of contract or some legal entity. I think it's helpful to reflect on these two kinds of deserving in light of the gospel, in light of this John text. So we can ask the question, who deserves the favor of God? Well, only Christ deserves the favor of God in this first earned sense, right? Because He lived a perfect human life of submission and obedience to His Father. He passed the test and did not fall into temptation. His favor, God's favor, is legitimately His. But Jesus takes this favor of God and He gives it away to us, who utterly fail to earn God's favor. We are the lawbreakers. Jesus gives to us the reward for His own faithfulness to the law. And so another way of talking about it, Jesus gives us His deservedness, right? We don't deserve anything, but Jesus gives us the deservedness that's rightfully His, but now it's ours. Deservedness before God. But because Christ Jesus took this action, taking the guilt of our sin on Himself and crediting His righteousness to us, we can claim our new status as children of God in Townsend's other sense of deserving. Like claiming the right to vote, not because I'm smart or good, but simply because this right was conferred on me by virtue of me being a citizen, right? I'm a citizen. I don't do anything further to deserve the right to vote, but it's been conferred on me. It's been given to me. So similarly, the Gospel of John, I think, in this first chapter is telling us we have the authority to claim the status that's been bestowed on us by Christ. It's really ours. We can have confidence. Paul talks about boasting in it. That's how confident. He's not boasting in himself. He's boasting in what Christ has done for him and how sure he is that it's real. And so that is a kind of authority, isn't it? This actually is, in a sense, entitlement. But it's legitimate entitlement, and it's entitlement that's been given to us by God. And that's where I'm going to end. And we, at Le Brie, we like to continue the conversation. If anybody wants to ask questions or share anything that relates to this topic or push back on things that I said or certainly clarification too, it's great. If you want to leave, it's been a long day, please feel free to head out. Nobody will be offended. But if you want to stick around, please do. Any thoughts? Yeah, Vince.
Some of the arguments that you were making, you know, were like about sacrifice and like having a duty and some things, you know, we'd all laugh like, well, because like, you know, like we see that as something that like, you know, we want to try to like, we want to,
yeah,
that, but like a lot of people are like, why would I want to sweat? Why would I, want things to be hard? Like if everything could possibly be easy for me,
yeah,
like that's the way I want it to be, and like that's why I'm striving to make more technology, or that's why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
So then it can become simpler for us, and that's the betterment of the human race, not sacrificing for each other. to, like, how would you talk to somebody about, like, trying to understand, or, like, is there, like, human limitations, or, like, in the character of God that we're made in, like, why that would want to be, and, like, how the other way is getting away, like, being more and more away from God, and, like, what original human being was meant as it was created, like, is there a separation in that?
If I understand you, I mean, I'm not trying to say that hardship and sacrifice is intrinsically good somehow, but it's just sometimes a fact of living in a fallen world that if we want something, we will have to give something else up. We can't have everything. I believe it's a good thing. I mean, the goodness of technology lies in its ability to make life easier. I mean, life is hard for a lot of people, and technology makes us able to do things that we otherwise could never do. And so there's no, I'm not saying that there's some kind of intrinsic goodness in pain and suffering and sacrifice, but given that we're living in a very fallen world that's been screwed up for a long time, and that fallenness goes right through the middle of each of us, there's no reason why we should expect to be immune from that kind of suffering. And so we're not entitled to be, to sort of step out from under the fall and exist in some other reality than the rest of the world. And so I think it's not to say that therefore suffering is good. It's to say that, it's something that's bad, but we should expect. Does that get at what you're saying?
Some kind of like joy in the process of growing, or like, you know, like actively like in the process of like growing and doing something like that's strenuous and like it can make you sweat, or like something that's like a work, like a relationship is work, like actively intentionally, like hardships to make it flourish. And then, but like a lot of people, like if everything could possibly feel like they're striving to make that more that way, and like they think that as like when you say that, okay, like as a Christian sometimes you maybe could be like, oh, you need to like not be doing that, or like this or that, because it's, you're making hard, like you're taking growth out of your life, or like taking hard things that potentially make you grow.
Yeah. And
their perspective, they're saying
it
as like you're trying to make life worse.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I would want to make a distinction between hard work and hardships. I mean, work can be messed up too, but working hard in order to achieve some goal, there's nothing wrong or fallen about that at all. But still, I don't, even though... But then that's quite distinct. Say training for something and getting in shape and being able to achieve something we couldn't have before we did all that work. That's a fact of life, and there's nothing wrong with that, and that's good. But sort of hardships through which we might mature and grow, I still don't think the hardships or the suffering or the disappointments or something, or the struggle in a relationship. I think you're talking about relational stuff when you're. You'll grow as a Christian and as a person through some of those struggles. It doesn't mean that those things are necessarily good, but it does mean that God can work on you through them. But it's not something we're supposed to go looking for. Or, you know what I mean? Like most people don't have to go looking for relational struggles. I don't know. Is there any other thoughts or anything? Yeah.
First of all, I really enjoyed everything you had to say.
Thanks.
A lot of it had really a lot of merit, and enjoyed it thoroughly. One of the things I was interested in was you talked a lot about entitlement being, I think we very often view it as a reward, as the addition of a positive thing. I do this, or I don't do this, and I receive this.
Mm-hmm.
But I see a lot of, in our society, and as it sort of relates to this, as really the removal of consequence. In that I am I'm owed this life where there are actions that I should be able to do what I need to do and want to do,
yeah,
and have the removal of that consequence, even with things like abortion. I mean, you know, that I should be able to do this and then not have to suffer the, I hate to label it this, but the consequences of acting in that way or something.
Yeah.
And I see that as a huge detriment, especially with the, you mentioned the universities.
Yeah.
And that began a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I think we're sort of reaping the benefits or the benefits of that now.
Yeah.
I should be able to eat what I want and not be overweight and get diabetic. So there's removal of those.
Yeah.
Bad consequences.
I should be able to live what, I mean, and I think modern medicine has enabled a new level of entitlement in that area too. I should be able to live whatever lifestyle I want and then take a pill and there'd be no consequences to that, right?
My personal story was, I mean, since I was 18, doctors were telling me, dude, you're going to get high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
When I turned like 38, they were like, okay, good, you got high blood pressure. I was like, okay, what do I do? Well, you take this pill.
Mm-hmm. Right, like, right.
Okay, cool.
So I didn't have to listen to you all those years.
Yeah, you gave me the pill. Like, 2 years later, they're like, dude, you're going to get diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, good, I got 20 years, you'll give me a pill, no problem. 2 years later, they're like, you got diabetes. I was like, I had 18 years left. So it's like, you know, it was this idea.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I was able to reverse that. But yeah, it's that idea that a lot of the technology and that access to instant information and the idea of knowledge without mastery, I can look it up on Google and Wikipedia, is the removal of that strife, the removal of that consequence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I remember a quote years ago. It was the somebody was quoted a couple days after Jerry Garcia died from the Grateful Dead. It was a sad day. But anyway, I think it was his manager or something like that said, you know, he was really starting to care for himself, his body and everything, and his body just let him down. And it was interesting to me. It was interesting, like...
Years of not
caring. I was like, as if there was no consequences to like super hard living for a long, long time and doing tons of drugs, and it's like, but the second he decided to do something different, then his body just screwed him over.
Yeah.
You know, what? I'm just like, really? Wow. Anyway, and I don't say that lightly. I mean, it was sad, but it's just like that's not the attitude towards health that we're supposed to have, right? Somehow. Yeah, Tom.
And partway through the lecture, when you were talking about the base level that we think we are entitled to from God, I think you were generally using the definition of we earned it. And the answer is we earned nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that there is a base level that Jesus has paid for. In fact, some of us would say that Jesus has paid for a whole lot more in his blood than most of us avail ourselves of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, you know, other than things that are true about heaven in the later life, that we can say, you know, I'm entitled to heaven, or I'm entitled to forgiveness. I mean, it seems to me that isn't there anything on earth that Jesus paid for that we're entitled to?
Mm. That's a great question.
Such as a sense of peace.
I'm going to open it to the floor for that.
In other words, I asked it as a genuine question because I've studied various people's conversions. I mean, C.S. Lewis, for a year, didn't believe he was going to heaven.
Yeah.
I think you know that, or perhaps you know that.
I'd heard it, yeah.
Yeah. And I've met many people who, for years, study with a sense of, am I even saved?
Mm-hmm.
And other people so don't have peace, don't have joy. I mean, what, it seems to me, in the voter's sense.
The voter's sense?
I'm a citizen. I have a vote.
Sorry. Yep.
Yeah, I'm a citizen. I have a vote.
Yep.
That by the second meeting, seems to me, I would throw that out there. Is there anything, is there some baseline thing that I can't expect? And if I don't have, I don't have to get angry at God. I can say something's amiss here.
Yeah. Yeah, awesome question. I'm not answering it, but I'm just giving an example of what the tension there. People like to say that God will never put more on you than you can bear. Does that mean that no? I don't think it's in the Bible, is it? I didn't think so. Anyway, if you believe that, then that means no true Christian will ever have a mental breakdown, ever, right? You know, so that's okay. If it's not in the Bible, then we can maybe disregard that. But I think the question is basically what are the promises? What are not the promises? One is that I will be with you till the end of the age. Mm-hmm. That no matter what happens, I'm going to be there. You may not know I'm there or feel like I'm there, but I will be with you.
I put that in the class of heaven. I put that in the class of, okay, I'm told this is true, and I have to philosophically wander through life believing it without experiencing it at all.
Okay, so you're talking about existential experience of God?
I'm asking, on earth, what can we... Yeah. I mean, if I were to take your snippets mm-hmm. of your talk literally, mm-hmm. it could be like I could be going through life thinking, "Gosh, I don't deserve heaven. I hope I make it, but maybe I'm not going to. I don't deserve forgiveness, but I hope I'm one of the lucky ones who God seems to forgive me. I'm going to go right down the list of everything that is supposedly mine mm-hmm. and say, well, I don't deserve it, and so I'm not sure if I'm going to get it. I shouldn't expect it."
That's not what I'm saying.
I said if I took that snippet, so now I'm trying to change it and say, is there anything that we can expect on earth? Mm-hmm.
Can we say that we can expect to grow or to bear fruit? These are things that, I mean, you've talked a lot about this, like things that that we often don't think are really happening because our definition of what that has to look like may be all over the place. I may think that I want more evidence that I'm actually growing spiritually, and I don't see it because I still struggle with this and this and this sin or whatever. And I actually am growing slowly with the help of the Holy Spirit and the impact of other Christians. And I don't know. Is that a promise? Yeah.
The difficult thing about the question is you're asking about something in this life, not just after we die.
Yeah.
But you're also asking something that's true for every Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to say what sort of a concrete experience in this life is going to be common to every Christian.
It's the lowest common denominator of Christian experience.
But I think what you said, what I've come across is that we are going to bear fruit. Mm-hmm. We may or may not recognize that. Mm. If we're a branch attached to the trunk of the tree, mm-hmm. we're going to bear fruit. Mm. And the Holy Spirit is in us. We're going to bear the fruit of the mm-hmm. Holy Spirit at work in us. There's mm-hmm. quite a long list of what that fruit mm-hmm. Involves. And so I think I would dare say that is common to every believer who mm-hmm. really believes and perseveres in faith, mm-hmm. that they will experience or grow in mm-hmm. the fruit of the Spirit and bear fruit to Christ. Again, how much they notice that, mm-hmm. how much they give thanks for that, treat that as a gift.
Experience it existentially.
It's very difficult to say, because people are so different, experiences are different, mm-hmm. to say, here are all the things that promises that pertain to every single living Christian.
Right.
Because things are so different in China.
Yeah. Second row,
The Bible's full of conditions, even salvation. If you confess with your mouth and believe in your mm-hmm. heart that Jesus Christ is Lord, you will be saved. Mm. Knock, and the door will be open. Mm-hmm. Abide in me, and I will abide in mm-hmm. you. If my people do this, mm-hmm. I will. Now, so it's not like an automatic entitlement. There mm-hmm. are things that we're called to do to kind of jumpstart, mm-hmm. what Jesus is going to do, how God will respond.
Or things we need to do in order to receive the gift.
Well, I don't think it's wrong to expect God to do those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? There is a transaction. Jesus says, let us reason together.
Yeah.
Though your sin be like mm-hmm. scarlet, it's going to be white mm-hmm. as snow, right?
Yeah.
It shouldn't be like, well, I hope that.
And
maybe God doesn't, maybe he lies sometimes. Maybe only mm-hmm. true some of the time.
Yeah.
And we just have to be lucky, like you're saying. You know, maybe Maybe I get it, maybe I don't. I don't know.
Yeah,
and I wonder if the family analogy is helpful in this. Like, I think you read us this quote from Townsend saying, you don't deserve anything, but I'll still provide things for you, which I think we kind of pushed back against a little bit, at least your mom did. And
I noticed some murmuring in the crowd.
Well, there's this kind of sense of, wait, that really jars.
Yeah.
I think there's a parallel, maybe, to the John passage, where God says, I give you the right to be kingdom of, or to be children of God. And in a sense, our children have certain entitlements or rights as by virtue of being our children, that we confer on them by being our children.
They have a status.
They have the right to our love for the rest of their life, no matter how, where they go. And some of those things might also be parallel with your question about what right do we have as children. It's not because we've necessarily earned our place as children of God, but we nonetheless have been
and we're supposed to have a significant part of the Christian life is having confidence in that, the solidity of that promise, and faith in God that He really means it. Yeah, absolutely. I like that because there is, because if you think of it in a negative sense, if I only say to my children, "You don't deserve anything," that leaves out the possibility of, well, if I actually really neglected my children, have I done anything wrong? I've denied something that was their due in some sense, right? And it's not because, I guess the distinction is, it's not because my care for them does not depend on their perfect behavior, I guess. And that's you don't deserve it because you're really great.
No.
You deserve it because your status, right?
Right.
If a child's legitimate needs have been neglected by their parents, then they have been sinned against. So that means their parents are guilty.
Yeah.
Which to me implies they have the right to be to be cared for by the people that God has given.
Yep.
Given that responsibility to.
Yeah. So the John passage again, for God to say, like, I've given you the right to be the children of God. He's almost taking on himself a certain set of responsibility.
Absolutely.
That, of himself,
he's binding himself to,
right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the way you handled that, I mean, that passage, I think it does speak to Tom's question, because I think we shouldn't be always questioning, am I saved? Am I going to be saved? Because it says those who believe and have received Him have the right, the authority to be children of God. So that means we can stand in that with
some assurance,
and fight that, you know, and recognize that those other voices as the devil, you know, as unfaith, as whatever, and really claim those that status, and confidence.
Yeah.
The reason I asked that question was that lots of discussions over the decades, when it comes down to what has God promised, I'm guaranteed that you can be sure by faith that He's done X, and that X is always in heaven, always something that can't be observed. But anything that might be observed on earth, you can't be sure of that. Something bothers me about that.
It's true, but again, what Dick was saying is that to demand something that's common to every single Christian's experience is very, very hard to say.
Asking is, is there some base level? I'm just asking the question.
Yeah. No, I wasn't being hostile.
Can we expect, that's why I said, on the planet, on Earth, in this life, is there something that we could, and if we're not getting it, as I said, not necessarily to shake our fist at God, but am I blind to something? Am I missing something? Is Jesus paid for something with His blood? Is Jesus weeping because I'm not taking advantage of something that He's done?
Yeah.
I mean, something.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that might very well be, yeah. I think of the... Yeah, we've had a couple of hands flying up here. Yes?
I would say, I mean, for one, like, kind of thing that you could expect on Earth is you could look at David's 23rd Psalm of Your will be done on Earth as it is in heaven. That's just kind of, you know, it's not an entitled asking, but it's, you know, it's if your will be done on earth as is in heaven, then let it be done. So mm-hmm. it's maybe less of a promise, but it's because it is in God's word, it is, you know, something that we should do in terms of, you know, our relationship with God, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it's an expectation or to pray expectantly, asking that God's will in heaven would be done, as it is in heaven, it's done on earth. Yeah, David.
I was wondering if there's two different conversations. Like mm-hmm. yours is more about an attitude of when we expect something, is it because we feel entitled or because we're grateful and
yeah.
we trust God is generous?
Right.
It's
right,
not
right,
about
right.
not expecting God to fulfill His promises.
Right.
That's
right.
not your lecture.
No.
I wonder if that's
yeah.
almost maybe a bit of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can trust God for a lot of things because He's yeah. generous. Or I could be like, well, of course He should do that for me. I mean,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
like a flippant,
mm-hmm. yeah.
ungrateful approach to God.
Right. Or I could be fall over so far on the other side of it, like, I deserve nothing before God. Why should you do anything nice for me? Why should my life have any joy in it at all? You know,
yes.
you know that's equally, well, that does violence to the biblical witness of who God is. That he actually is, Okay, yeah, you first and then you. Yeah. Go ahead.
One thing, like the right to vote. I mean, mm-hmm. I thank God that I'm an American. You mm-hmm. know, and I've spent 10 years in the armed services, mm-hmm. and I know about what it took mm-hmm. for America to be
yeah.
born.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, dragging cannons from, you know, Fort Ticonderoga to yeah. Dorchester Heights. You know,
yeah.
you want to talk about
yeah, that's not an easy road. Yeah,
and then you're not even using them.
yeah, I mean the
Lake Champlain. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
so
yeah, I'm entitled to vote,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't mean I'm not thankful
yeah.
for my position.
Yeah.
And so I don't think in every case those two are like. I mean, I loved your lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of, you know, deep mm-hmm. points and mm-hmm. makes me really think about stuff, but they're not always mutually exclusive,
No, yeah.
And here's yeah. another one that's kind of always kind of blown me away. This is in 1 John chapter 1,
mm-hmm.
and it's verse 9. If we confess our sins, He is faithful and righteous, and some translations say just,
mm-hmm.
to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So
mm-hmm.
when we confess our sin, He's not doing us a solid. That's mm-hmm. not a favor.
Yeah.
It's like, if you do it, yeah, I'm pretty generous, I'll forgive it. It's
yeah.
the right thing for Him to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Because God is righteous,
mm-hmm.
when He forgives us, it's not a favor,
mm-hmm.
it's righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
His forgiveness is completely, totally just.
Yeah.
Because of what Jesus did. So I'm like,
mm-hmm.
thank you, Lord Jesus,
yeah.
for doing that for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But
yeah.
I'm just now.
But if it wasn't for
I'm just.
If it wasn't for Christ's crucifixion, it would not have been just.
No, absolutely.
For Him to give that to
but
us.
But I
yeah.
have His righteousness.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because no one is going to go into heaven with a single spot in the
mm-hmm.
Bible. It's coming for a spotless bride.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning every bad thing you did is
mm-hmm.
going to be completely gone.
Mm-hmm.
As if it never happened.
Yeah.
So we do have that position.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not arrogance.
No.
Right? Because we didn't do it, like
yep.
you said. I mean, Paul's saying, you didn't earn this.
Yeah.
But we got it.
I like. It's an interesting thing to reflect on what Paul means by boasting in Christ Jesus. I find it's worth kind of like mulling that over quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's clearly not, he more than anybody is convinced of his own unworthiness to come before God. He knows that he's... you know, the passage in 1 Corinthians 4 that talks about, I don't count myself judged by any human court. I don't even judge myself.
Right.
I mean, he is more convinced than probably anybody that his status is secure before God because of Jesus Christ. What Jesus Christ has done. And now he can go and preach the gospel to people whose relatives he probably killed. You know, that's how... That's how confident he is in Christ's forgiveness.
Right.
You know,
center,
yeah, yeah.
And then
he can boast in that. That's just quite amazing. We're ahead of the question. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say a couple of things.
Yeah.
Number one, I very much appreciate what you had to say.
Thanks.
Echoing what other folks have said, obviously well thought out. The issue about whether or not we have a right to
mm-hmm.
expect anything.
Mm-hmm.
You're comments about electronics that were very, I think, thoughtful and appropriate. And I don't know Greek, but according to one of the apps that I got, mm-hmm. the Greek word is exousia, which means privilege mm-hmm. or capacity or competence.
Is this in the John 1? The John 1 chapter?
Yes.
Yeah. Privilege, yes.
That's why I'm out here in Europe. I didn't make that connection.
Okay.
In the John 1 passage.
Yeah.
It can be translated privilege. Mm-hmm. And I looked at a couple other translations, quick, and one of the other ones had it be that could be but privilege.
Okay. I guess it's privilege.
And
authority.
It, as a privilege, it's like, I guess my thought is that almost any, I mean, I guess I agree very much with mm-hmm. the premise of what you're saying tonight, that everything we get from God is a gift, mm-hmm. free. Mm-hmm. Our breath, our heartbeat, mm-hmm. our,
not
peace we have.
Yes.
Yeah,
not love.
Exactly. is a gift from God. And in that sense, we're not entitled, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in an entitled sense, like you said,
yeah.
to anything. From
yeah.
We stand before Him. I love the shape right now. Yeah. We stand before Him empty-handed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's how we come to
Him. Yeah, and part of our growth as believers is to be more and more comfortable with that reality, yeah. and not resentful. We're totally dependent. That's what you are as a creature of God, and it's great. That's what you were made. That's what you were made for. Yeah.
Say donation. Right. Something that we can give to Him.
Yeah. John in the back, then you.
I don't want to steer the discussion away from faith, but at the very beginning you said entitlement's a culture-wide thing. Mm-hmm. And you read this passage about the university system mm-hmm. and kind of laughed a little. Mm-hmm. I guess my question is it how did it become that way? Mm-hmm. And is it just a different generation looking down on more of the millennials or whatever? Mm-hmm. So I'm
kind of grappling
with that.
Yeah. The historical leading up to some of the examples of entitlement, I think I am ill-equipped to answer that question in any helpful way, but I will say that it is it seems to be a human trend for each generation to think the younger generation is more entitled than they are and were when they were there, and so there's certainly a risk of real pride, I think, that goes along with older folks looking to the younger folks and just the kids, the kids these days, what they're entitled to, and how ungrateful they are, and how they expect everything to be done for them, even if some of those things are true. It's a real risk, I think.
You don't see our own entitlements.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's probably one of the things I was saying is that you entitlement is always easier to see in other people because it's the assumption that, yeah, so.
Some of this is the result of critical theory from the Frankfurt School, mm-hmm. Which has just morphed into feminism mm-hmm. and white privilege. It's communism.
But that's a great example of the white privilege thing. Yeah. It's not something anybody talked about a generation ago. Mm-hmm. And now students are more aware of white privilege, mm-hmm. even if they're also maybe more sensitive to trigger mm-hmm. warnings.
Critical
theory provides no solution mm-hmm. to it, right? Yeah. Other than to give your money to somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's communism. Yeah.
To respond to that, I think the problem is that the solution we're making is taking away rights to speak rather than instilling better values. Mm-hmm. So if we had better values, we wouldn't speak harsh things and offensive things because we're speaking out of good values and virtues and love. Mm-hmm. But we're not teaching good values, and so the only other response is to take away freedom of speech or create a fear to speak. Mm-hmm.
I think
actually, you talk about, and we look down at generations coming up behind us and look at them as entitled, but aren't we, in a very real way, responding with entitlement? You should listen to us. Mm-hmm. We've got wisdom over you. We've got miles on these tires.
Yeah.
This hair can go gray or fall out. Mm-hmm. On its own.
Yeah.
There's
we're responding in kind.
Sure. No, yeah, absolutely.
So how do we expect them yeah. to respond?
Yeah, yeah. I think one aspect of it is I mean, there's a million different cultural things going on that it's over my head, but sort of a lot of people are, young people and older people too, are pretty at sea in terms of what their identity is, like no idea who they actually are, and there is a tremendous lack of meaning for all kinds of people, but you could certainly see it in millennials. Just like what is, you know, I'm trying to discover who I am and find some sense of meaning and purpose, but there's not a lot being offered and not a lot of good answers there. Apart from the church, which is trying, you know, but the church isn't always doing a good job. So I think people are there is quite an identity to be found in victimhood, which is, this is just looking at the one specific, these are the ways in which I've been wronged. This is the way in which I can connect with other people who've been wronged in the same way. And that's not necessarily a bad thing at all. That's why support groups are helpful, you know, for me. But identity, human identity is too big and too significant a thing to be defined by just that. And so I think so much of the pain and confusion and anguish we see there is people, because by and large the Christian faith has been abandoned, the doctrine of the image of God has been abandoned, and people are searching for some kind of sense of who they are that does justice to the feeling of significance that they have, but they've got no way of defending that. On what grounds am I significant? None, you know. And yet they're made in the image of God still, and they experience that as a huge void. And so that's one of the reasons why the image of God is such an important thing for Christians to be talking about. That, you know, there's millions of people out there who are viewing themselves as less significant than I view them as a Christian. Mm-hmm. You don't know how significant you are, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's just one very, very broad thing that's happening. And then I think this is something we're hopefully going to talk about next term. We're debating whether to do a theme weekend on the question of happiness, God and happiness. People, you know, social scientists and people who are studying the youth today and looking at the attitudes of college students and, oh no, you know, what's going on? They're very quick to point out and identify and diagnose the problem, which is these kids have no sense of meaning. That's why they're so unhappy. They have no sense of purpose and a higher meaning and everything. But then the solution is not, let's ask that question. What does life mean? Is there actually a source of meaning out there? Those questions never get asked. The whole conversation turns towards techniques about how to get happier, basically. And so that it's just not a sufficient answer. You know?
I think a lot of people are going to college or university because they feel like that's what they have to do for the next step.
Yeah.
More so than any other generation, people are going to college and they're getting out and they're not feeling fulfilled by that.
Mm.
Maybe they shouldn't have gone to college
yeah.
first place.
Yeah. You're going to college because they don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah,
that's the. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I do know one thing, over one of what I hear, why do I go to college? Why do we need a good education to get a good job, a good paying job on graduation?
Yeah.
And that's not what this guy was referring to.
Mm-hmm.
He was referring to education for life.
Yeah.
That education was much more than just getting a good job
yeah.
on graduation. So the whole thing is commodified.
Yeah.
The backdrop.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Which means I purchase
mm-hmm.
whatever I get at college to work for me, and I treat college the way I treat all my other purchases, which is they're meant to work the way I want them to.
Yes. Yeah. Deliver the product.
So
yeah.
Hear what different colleges do.
Yeah.
Almost every college, I think, has a department.
how deal and shape our whole university to appeal to the U.S. News and World Report standard.
Yeah.
And how do we advertise ourselves? What do we do with our investments? Mm-hmm. What do we? Where do we put our football team? Where, you know, the whole the role of the U.S. News and World Report ranking system.
Yeah.
Has a huge steering.
Dictates so much. Yeah.
Where do you want to go to college? Where
yeah.
Look at the U.S. News and World Report thing. Mm-hmm. That's where they line up their applications. Mm-hmm. And so it's the whole thing is so commodified.
Yeah.
I think it makes it vulnerable to whatever people don't want to hear when they get there.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be that they may have, you know, there are microaggressions for this or for that or for anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But it's behind that, I think, is this thing that education is commodity now.
Yeah.
So we, of course, if I paid for it, I paid for a certain thing, so
yeah.
I can expect.
Yeah, if I buy my candy bar, I'm not expected to do anything else to earn that candy bar after I give the money.
Or to be an orange or beef instead.
Yeah.
Candy bar.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That would be disappointing. Yeah. Marty, then Tom.
Yeah. I think it also starts really young with a certain kind of child rearing view that is saying it's that every child should get the star, every child should be told they're winners, and rather than a sort of recognition. Helping kids grow up, we're all different. We have different strengths, we have different weaknesses. Somebody's going to do well in this thing, and someone's going to do well in that. But, that idea that I think that fits the idea that we're all princesses, we're all this, we're all that. Not because of having achieved anything, but then you get to college and you get the kind of the quote that you had that it's the college's job. You know, we're all smart and beautiful and wonderful. And we've been told that by our parents and by our teachers.
The institution has the obligation to deliver results, not opportunity. Yeah.
You know, being loved and accepted for who I am, with my strengths and weaknesses, not being told you can do anything and have anything just because you can if you want it.
What's that? Was that high school graduation speech that went viral a couple of years ago about like you can't do everything you want? You can't. What was it? Does anyone remember that? I don't remember who it was, but it was like people find that refreshing because I think we're tired of like you can do anything you want if you put your mind to it. This is America. You're awesome. And then it was like no, you can't. Sorry, like you can't. What's that?
The world we live in. The truth is so shocking.
Yeah.
The truth caused such a ripple.
Yeah.
The truth went viral.
Yeah. but maybe offended people, but a lot of people watched that because they thought, wow, someone's finally like not. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, Tom.
Picking up on that a little bit, there's an early question about entitlement, where did it come from? My father and mother, and many aunts and uncles, saw a snippet of the Roaring Twenties, went through the Great Depression.
Yep.
And World War II, and saw childhood friends die of infections that antibiotics were fixed.
Yeah.
Saw people go into polio, people get polio.
Yeah.
They came out and they hit the 1950s. Mm-hmm. They weren't feeling very entitled.
Yeah.
They were feeling grateful.
Yeah.
That the world had calmed down and that they could live in peace and safety.
Yeah.
And then there was a generation. And they never dreamed. My folks never dreamed of the thing that one of the most valuable things they could teach me would be how to make choices in a land of abundance.
Yeah, And then
I think there are some generational things that
happen. Sure, absolutely.
I'm not trying to condemn anybody.
I'm definitely not trying to condemn anybody.
But I think there's been this whole thrust of, and look at America. The Bill of Rights. We think we're since. Long before my parents were born, we think we're entitled to the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
We think we're entitled to justice. I mean, our court systems are relatively fair compared to many countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's many things that we've just come to take for granted, like that policemen aren't corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're offended when politicians and policemen aren't corrupt. So I think there's a general thrust that we've come to. And each generation has its own little thing, but
that's why it's so helpful to speak to people from other countries in which those things are not assumed, and people from other generations, and to recognize what it is that we are actually enjoying. That's certainly something that the lack of intergenerational contact has really done a lot of damage, I think,
you know, everybody just hangs out with people who are their age and nobody actually hears any other narrative or story. And that's kind of what I was talking about it takes to be thankful, it takes imagination. We need to just imagine some other kind of existence other than our affluent, comfortable existence. Because if we can't think of anything other than what we have and what we're comfortable with, then of course we're going to be entitled to it. Yes.
Hi. As somebody who has worked in elementary education for a long time, who has been a parent, and I think the social sciences and psychology have contributed to lousy parenting. Don't make your kids upset, you know, they can do anything kind of stuff. But I don't feel so hopeless because I have seen educators who are concerned about teaching resilience and character education, and you got to work to get what you want.
Yeah.
And I think there are people who do go to college thinking they have to work
because
they want to get the grade. You know, it's
absolutely
not,
yeah.
It's not a total thing, and I think it would be nice if the pendulum was swinging the other way. And we talked about how to teach resilience to our kids and how to make tough choices and what to do when the world tells you no.
Yeah.
And I think there are pockets where people are really trying to do that.
Yep.
There's even an article about let's make playgrounds less safe.
Yeah, oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah. Like that one in Wales where there's like fires and tires and broken glass. They're like, go play.
Right.
Yeah.
So kids
it's awesome.
Learn. They got to watch out
and stub
their toe. It's not the end of the world.
Right.
I guess I'm not totally hopeless.
No, and yeah, that's awesome to hear, yeah.
Where people are being taught that you got to work together.
Yeah. And whenever you talk about trends, like I've been talking about, I'm speaking in generalizations. Thankfully, right? They're not universal. Thankfully, so it's I believe you.
I also see those parents who think their kids ought to get good grades no matter what.
This is something Simon Sinek talks about. He talks about how professors in high school and college just give kids good grades because they don't want to deal with the parents.
Right.
Yeah. There's such an aversion to dealing with parents who will definitely complain. So
one thing I know we talked about as a right of citizens and the right to vote. One thing I think sometimes we lose is that the right to vote does not equal the right to win. As evidenced by some incidents 16 months ago.
Yeah.
But the other thing, and to the gentleman, I believe his name is Tom, up front. I was struck by the question of what we can expect, and the one promise that I think that God makes unconditionally is that I will be with you. And we talked about the person of Christ and the one person, the one man who walked the earth who had a claim to truly be entitled to these things. In the end, didn't even have that. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why did we, as a fallen people, expect more? That's our sense of entitlement. You had even said to be conscious of food that we woke up this morning. I suddenly became conscious of every breath that I take. It's automatic. And we're not promised that. I'm not promised this moment or this moment or this moment. And so we can make plans. I think we're supposed to make plans and provide for the people that are in our care. But I'm not entitled to this next breath. When Christ himself wasn't entitled to those things. So I think God's promise that he will be with us, that he will not abandon us, is that hope that leads to the next life. But I don't know. I don't know that I can honestly say that I'm entitled to anything in this life. And that's the struggle of faith. That's my honest thought.
Yeah, I mean, with a lot of our conversations is sort of circling around this idea of entitlement. Is it entitlement based on some virtue in ourselves, or entitlement based on a promise that's been made by God? And I think that's a key distinction. We can really put our weight on the promises of God, but never in a way that assumes it's somehow. We're giving him some reason to love us, I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
We love him because he loved us first. Yeah. That's scripture.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Awesome.
I was thinking, I think it's kind of been said a little bit, but in terms of things to do, I think one thing would be to pursue diversity across age groups. Mm-hmm. Because part of the reason that younger people might not seem to know, although I think some people might underestimate them. I'm on the cutoff, so I don't know that I'm actually a millennial.
You don't identify as a millennial?
Okay. But mostly because I feel like it's like the old joke about, like, pray for me, I've got teenagers. And I'm like, they can hear you. They can hear you when you complain about them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, millennials don't want to hang out with people who are shaming them.
Yeah.
But
who would?
Like, you need them and they need you. Like, we need each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's and I'm not saying that, it's like you said earlier, it's like fashionable, like whatever the previous generation is, like, oh, these kids in the 60s and they're long hair, and you're like, okay, but now you're complaining about the other ones. So, and I'll probably complain about the ones that are like my nephew's age. But I think that our society is prone towards age segregation, even within the context of our education systems. So it's harder to go towards what is different. Mm-hmm. But I think that that might be something that would be helpful.
There's all kinds of good reasons why there should be less age segregation and more contact between generations in the church. I mean, the church should not be guilty of this. The church is quite age segregated in a way that's really, it's quite destructive, I think. Yeah. One more question. Yeah.
Well, it's age segregated, it's race segregated, it's class segregated, and I think some of the most meaningful experiences I've ever had have been in Nicaragua and Guatemala doing dirty work with people who love the Lord as much as I did. And I think we do stay in our little silos, and we think we're entitled to have a dishwasher in the kitchen and two cars in the garage.
Yeah. And I think, and you're right about the segregation along race and ethnicity and economic, but with age segregation, that happens within one church. I mean, you can have one church, even if it's not very diverse at all racially, but the teenagers never see the adults.
Right.
And the kids never, and the young marrieds never hang out. You know, it's just like, wow. So there's a lack of integration of people who are different from each other, not just among churches out there, but within a single church. Because the assumption is nobody can possibly be expected to relate to anybody who's a different generation.
Totally unbiblical, because I've done a lot of work on this subject and lectured on it. And when you actually go to the scripture and look at the different words in the Greek and Hebrew for different age groups, there's exhortations to every age group as to learn from the other ones and to model for the others. So the except you become like a child, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. If you don't know any children, you're not going
to
know that.
Speaking to grown-ups. Yeah.
Yeah, that's to disciples. And be innocent as an infant. It talks about infants being innocent of premeditated evil, and they're meant to be models for us. Well, if you don't have ever seen an infant, you don't know what that means. And the youth, which is the Hebrew word for youth, for young person, for adolescent, is he or she who shakes free. And they're described as strong. And so the strength of youth. And so the church, and the church was born at Pentecost with the young shall dream dreams, the old shall see visions, and the church needs both, the visions of the old and the dreams of the young. We need them both. And so I really appreciate what you said, Allison, because you're right. Why? I mean, the word teenager was first coined in the 1940s as a marketing tool, how to market to this growing large group. And then it's a way of objectifying this particular age group, and they don't like it.
Victims to their hormones.
Why would they, to be objectified and stereotyped in one particular slot. So.
Okay, last one.
I was just curious about how you would view kind of the story of Abraham and how he, he was promised by God to be the father of many nations, and then I think through his entitlement of when it would happen and his kind of, you know, pursuit of convenience. He had a child with the servant, Ishmael, rather than his wife.
Well, Hagar was the servant, yeah.
Yes.
Yep, yep.
And so I'm curious as to how you would view that in terms of entitlement and, you know, because if it was God's will for him to be the father of many nations, would that be considered entitlement or part of the promise that God, you know, gave him?
Well, good question. I guess I read that as Abraham believing God's promise and then losing heart over many, 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 many years, and still believing that this was the promise, but trying to grasp for something to make it come true.
It was Sarah's
idea. And losing faith but whatever Sarah suggested, Abraham, as the authority in that culture, went along with it. So I think that's, and then, so I don't think it was God's intention for Abraham and Sarah to do that, but after they did, God still blessed the fruit of that decision. Because he was kind to Hagar and Ishmael. To me, I don't know. I don't know whether it's entitlement as much as it was. He did believe that this promise was going to be fulfilled, but, whoa, she's, what, 90 or 100 years old at the time? To me, I read it as kind of like, we have to take matters into our own hands here now, otherwise this is...
Unless I misunderstood what God said.
Maybe. Yeah, well, I don't know how I would behave if I was given a promise of something and then maybe didn't really hear much from God for 60 years, maybe. Who knows how long it was. You know? It's a good question.
I think we all do it.
Yeah.
That's where we get there
as well. All the time.
We have an idea of what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Okay, how much of it am I going to do and how much is God going to do?
Yeah. Yeah, and is this a time to wait on the Lord? Is this a time to try to find something expedient? Thank you, everybody. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What's your name?
Caleb.
Caleb, good to meet you. I'm Ben. Thanks for coming.
Yes, thank you for teaching.
Yeah.
So I found this really enriching, and you know, I'll definitely think about this as I go into seminary in August.
So you're in August. Where are you going?
I'm between two places right now. We'll be visiting them in like just 2 weeks.
Next week.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Both in Missouri. So
okay.
two big choices. So
okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, God bless you in that endeavor. It's a big decision. Yeah.
We really enjoy it. Thank you.
Thank you. What's your name?
Scott.
Scott.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Awesome. Thanks for coming.
Thank
where,
you.
Where are you all from?
We're in Douglas.
Okay.
We live just down, you know where it is?
Not exactly. Okay. I mean, if
the one town that
I know it exists.
Connecticut, Rhode Island.
Okay.
Connecticut, Rhode Island. We're right there.
Okay, right. I see. Okay, yeah.
Not far at all. But
cool.
Very cool.
Good. Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
So, all right. Good to see you again.
Oh, did we talk last week?
I think so, yeah.
I have a horrible memory.
We talked about animals
Ben?
Communicating. Ben.
You're Ben.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, okay.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Good.
Long week. This is the last one in the lecture series.
That's right, yeah.
How often does it kind of rotate through?
So we have a break time now, and our students who are here will be going home next week, and then we start a new term. First week of May, I think.
Okay.
And then we'll start up our lectures throughout the summer. Yeah, okay. It'll be like 11 or 12 weeks, something like that.
I moved here back in September and still have not found a church. This has been like church life for me. It's been really nice.
Good. Where are you living?
I live in Braintree.
Okay. Yeah.
Quincy area.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're a speech pathologist, is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
Have you talked to Mary Frances at all, who works here?
Yeah, the first time I came, I met her and chatted, made that connection.
Chatting a little speech pathology.
Yes. Aaron was telling me that there's some kind of Tennessee connection.
Yeah, is that where you're from?
Well, I went to school there. Okay. That's where I moved from most recently.
There seems to be lots of people who come here from Tennessee.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Like a lot of Chattanooga folks. And there's a couple. Yeah, someone from Greenville, Tennessee, which is like, you know, country. And then Shauna from Nashville, another woman who's here from. Oh no, one of our students is from Knoxville. Really, lots of Tennessee people.
Yeah, that's funny.
I don't know what it is.
Nice. Well, I was just going to ask, is there like any kind of email list I can join?
If you go anywhere at the door, there's just a little guest book thing there.
Okay.
Just write your name and your email address, and you'll be put on. There's like a lecture schedule and a newsletter that we send out at the beginning of each term. So
okay.
You won't.